I'm Jeff Sickinga, Executive Director of the Ashbrook Center, and this is The American Idea, where we discuss the ideas, people, and events that have made America what it is today. We believe that by understanding our history and our principles, we can better live up to the promise of the American founding and preserve our ongoing experiment in self-government. Welcome to The American Idea.
Welcome, everyone, to this episode of The American Idea. Today, we're going to be talking about a consequential American, an American president of the 20th century who recently passed away. And I think it seems appropriate for us now to take some time to recollect the life and the presidency and post-presidency of Jimmy Carter. And I am joined for that conversation today by someone who probably knows as much about the American presidency as any person alive, Professor Steve Knott. Our listeners, many of you know Steve. He has extensive experience, academic and professional experience, studying the presidency. He co-chaired the Presidential Oral History Project at the wonderful Miller Center for the American Presidency at the University of Virginia, where he helped to initiate and lead a number of their important projects. He is Professor Emeritus from the United States Naval War College, taught there for a number of years on issues of national security, foreign policy, and the American presidency. And I'm also delighted to say that he is the Thomas and Mabel Guy Professor in American History and Government at Ashland University, teaching in the master's program here with us. He is a terrific teacher. Those of you who may have had him, he is also a prolific author. Steve, I think I counted at least 10 books and monographs of yours over the years. A few deserve mention, particularly for this topic. He has a great book on Washington and Hamilton. He has a book called Secret and Sanctioned, the Conduct of American Foreign Policy. I would be remiss if I didn't note this wonderful volume two, American Foreign Policy, to 1899, a core documents volume edited by Steve. And of course, two more recent books, The Lost Soul of the American Presidency, which I'm sure we can factor into this conversation, and his most recent, which is really a wonderful moving book called Coming to Terms with JFK. It's personal and academic reflections on the Kennedy presidency. Steve Knott, thanks again for joining us on The American Idea.
Well, thank you, Jeff, for that warm introduction. Part of the reason you referred to me as a leading expert on the American presidency, I'm at the age where I've lived through most of these presidencies. So,
well, you
like George Washington, but
almost. Maybe not that far. Well, you lived through the Carter presidency, and a number of our listeners, of course. I did too, but a number of our listeners may not have or don't have a strong grasp on Jimmy Carter before he became president. Talk about Carter's rise to the presidency.
Yeah, Carter is a classic American success story in many ways. Came from a relatively obscure background from Plains, Georgia. His father was a farmer. A peanut farmer. Carter himself, the future president, helped to manage that warehouse in Plains. That was a key part of their whole agricultural enterprise. But I would say one of the foremost breaks that young Jimmy Carter received in his life, and it's not a break, I mean, the man earned it, but he was appointed to the United States Naval Academy in 1943, I believe it was, and then graduated from the Naval Academy in 1946 and came to the attention of what was going to become a very important facet of the U.S. Navy, and that was its nuclear submarine fleet, part of the strategic deterrence triad of the United States. And Admiral Rickover, Hyman Rickover, a legendary figure in naval circles, saw something in Carter that other folks would see later on, that this was an incredibly hardworking individual, very bright, extremely bright, a quick learner. And so I would say that's the key break or key development in Carter's young life that's going to propel him into public service. So service in the Navy under Rickover, that is cut short in 1953. I believe I got that date right, when Carter's father passes away, and Naval Officer Jimmy Carter has to return to Plains, or opts to return to Plains to run the family warehouse. And of course, it's at that point that he's going to reestablish his roots in Georgia. He had moved around quite a bit as a naval officer, so he had lost touch for a time with the folks in Georgia. But upon his father's death in 1953, returns to the warehouse. And by 1962, he's thinking about a run for the Georgia State Senate. I should point out, Jeff, after having served on various school boards, he was always very interested in education. So at the local level, he was actively engaged. By 1962, he's got his eyes on the Atlanta State House, and he will serve two terms as a Georgia State Senator.
How does Carter then move into and up in the Democratic Party of Georgia?
Yeah, it's a great question, Jeff, and it's kind of a it's not an easy rise. That is the Georgia Democratic Party of the 1960s is still very much, with a few exceptions, a bastion of segregationists. And for instance, one of the key figures, one of Carter's contemporaries in Georgia, is Governor Lester Maddox, a Democrat who had made a name for himself as a restaurant owner who refused to serve black customers and had supposedly chased a black customer off with an axe in his hand. And so those axes, believe it or not, became part of Maddox's statewide campaigns. They were a symbol of this arch segregationist. This is the party that Jimmy Carter is attempting to rise to the top of. And I'm mentioning that, Jeff, because at the state level, Carter in this phase of his life is trying to walk something of a fine line. He has, for perhaps in comparison to most of his contemporaries, fairly progressive views on race. But he also knows that winning, particularly in the Democratic Party in Georgia, that being seen as progressive on race was not a plus. And there are going to be occasions, I would say, where Carter trims a bit on, perhaps even more than a bit, on this issue. He runs for the governor of Georgia in 1966. He loses that race in the Democratic primary. And I think one of the lessons he takes away from that defeat is, again, this racial issue, this racial time bomb can make or break a candidacy. When he runs again for governor in 1970, he's going to make some statements that will come back to haunt him. He accuses one of his Democratic primary opponents of being too pro-civil rights. His campaign circulates photographs of this a man by the name of Carl Sanders, of Sanders with, for instance, black athletes from the Atlanta Hawks and elsewhere, to suggest that Sanders is too close to African Americans. It's a dirty campaign, which, by the way, Carter will later regret and apologize for. But in 1970, he succeeds. He wins the gubernatorial race in Georgia. And at that point, he begins to come to the attention of the Democratic Party nationwide, because Carter's inaugural address, there's a fairly stunning line in which he says that, "I tell you now," he's speaking to the citizens of Georgia, "and hear me good, the days of racial segregation in Georgia are over." And that captures the national media's attention and captures the attention of the Democratic National Committee members.
So then he goes on to serve, of course, as governor of Georgia. Is it regarded by himself, people in Georgia, or the National Democratic Party as a success? How does it position him for the 1976 presidential election?
I think it is seen somewhat of a success, Jeff, not only due to what's seen as a somewhat progressive stance on racial matters, but also he is a reformer, in particular when it came to having a kind of business sense, wanting to reform spending and taxation and budgetary matters in the state of Georgia. That, in a way, is classic Carter. This is a detailed guy, and he's not afraid to get down into the roots of some pretty intricate budgetary matters. And so he's seen as a reformer in that regard. And also, Jeff, coupled with that, he's seen as entirely uncorruptible. And I do think this is a thread that's going to permeate Carter's public service, whatever one may think of him, excuse me, think of his policies. It's extremely rare to see anyone, if at all, question his integrity, question his probity. So a reform-minded governor of a deep southern states with somewhat progressive views on race, that 1-year term, again, is going to bring him to the attention of folks in the Democratic Party. And I don't want to overstate that. When we get to 1976, he still has a national name recognition of, I think, at best, 3%.
Wow. So how does he go from a 3% name recognition to becoming the Democratic nominee to run against Gerry Ford?
Yeah, I mean, the timing in a way could not have been better for Carter. 1976, where the country is reeling from Watergate, and Nixon resigned in August of 74. Corruption had been a major issue in the 74 off-year elections. Vietnam was still percolating. The government of South Vietnam had collapsed in April 1975. The United States had washed its hands of any responsibility for that war, despite the efforts of President Ford at the last minute to try to save the South Vietnamese government. Watergate, Vietnam, and one other issue, Jeff, that is forgotten today, but was a symbol of an imperial presidency and of a federal government that was abusing its powers, particularly a presidency abusing its powers. And that was the Central Intelligence Agency and the FBI. Both were accused of massive, wide-scale civil liberties violations. And Carter, being the outsider, being a man whose religious faith, to the extent that folks knew him, was crystal clear, being a governor with no scandals attached, is able to present himself as a guy who's going to clean up this mess in Washington as an outsider with no connections to the folks who led us into Vietnam or caused the Watergate scandal or, oversaw a runaway CIA or FBI. Now, again, I don't want to underestimate, Jeff, this is a hard sell because there were 16 candidates in the Democratic primary.
16. Wow.
16. 16. And Carter had a lower name recognition than most of those 16. Fred Harris, Scoop Jackson, George Wallace. Sergeant Shriver, a Kennedy in-law who was McGovern's running mate in 72, Morris Udall, a prominent liberal House member from Arizona. I mean, the list goes on and on. And Carter had to fight his way through that field of 16. And one of the first places he succeeds is in the Iowa caucuses. And again, it's this pitch of, I'm honest, I will never betray you, I'm a reformer, and I'm progressive enough on racial issues that you Northerners do not have to fear me.
So he is able, of course, to secure the nomination, goes on to run against Gerry Ford. What's the big defining campaign issue of the 76 election?
In my view, Jeff, it was Ford's pardon of Richard Nixon. Ford had pardoned Nixon 2 years earlier, September of 74, but that issue was still hanging over Ford's head, particularly among Democrats. And I think there's a good case to be made that had Ford not pardoned Nixon, he may well have won in 1976. It was a fairly narrow victory for Jimmy Carter in 76. In fact, it comes down to your state of Ohio, Jeff, that really puts Carter over the top. It's hard to believe now that Ohio went blue in 1976, but it did. But I would say the Ford's pardon of Nixon, and just again, Carter over and over again saying, "You, the American people, have been betrayed by your government." Watergate's an example of that. Vietnam, CIA, FBI abuses. Gerry Ford has been in Washington, D.C. as a member of the House of Representatives since the early 50s. He's part of the problem. Vote for me. I'm the outsider. I'll clean things up. And Carter would use language. Today, I don't think it would fly, Jeff, but he would give these speeches in which he would say, I will never lie to you. I will be as good and as decent as you, the American people, are. You've been betrayed. This is not your fault. This is the fault of those Washington insiders. He never used the term deep state, but there was kind of an implication, particularly when it came to FBI and CIA scandals, that there was this permanent government, this invisible government in DC that had betrayed you, and I'm going to clean out the stable.
So once he wins this narrow election, as you say, he becomes president. What are the issues facing Carter as president?
Yeah, domestically, Jeff, I would say primarily it's what some folks refer to as stagflation, a stagnant economy, while at the same time with runaway inflation that's only going to get worse for much of Carter's presidency, and an ongoing sort of semi-permanent energy crisis. The OPEC, Organization of Petroleum Exporting Countries, had slapped an embargo against the United States for our support of Israel under President Nixon. And that threat was looming over the United States throughout the 70s, actually into the early 80s. So I would say energy was a major issue, inflation on the domestic front. On the foreign policy front, again, Carter promised a change. Gone was going to be the era of the Nixon-Ford détente. In that, well, let me qualify that, Jeff. We were going to pursue détente with the Soviet Union, but we were going to make human rights, the status of Soviet dissidents, we're going to put that on par with restraining the growth of nuclear weapons. That sets Carter apart from Ford and Nixon. They had a tendency to sort of perhaps downgrade human rights. Carter is going to put human rights front and center, much to the Soviets' dismay, by the way.
I can imagine. On the domestic side, stagflation, the energy crisis, Jimmy Carter's sort of, as you suggest, perhaps sort of in the middle of the Democratic Party. He's
Yes.
certainly not the Ted Kennedy wing, not the George Wallace wing by any chance. How does Carter propose to deal with these crises, and how are his proposals met with in Congress?
Yeah, they are met with an excellent question, Jeff, because the Democrats have massive control of both the House and the Senate. I mean, the Republicans were really not capable of blocking any legislation. So with that stated up front, there were high expectations that Carter would have his way. He does meet with some success. It's not true that he was a complete failure as a legislative wizard. He's not Reagan, he's not Lyndon Johnson. He does meet with some success. But because the Democratic Party had these enormous majorities, it was extremely difficult, particularly in the House, for Speaker Thomas O'Neill, Tip O'Neill, to discipline that body. There was a very, very liberal wing, the so-called Class of 74, that came in, very left. And you still had a number of Southern Democrats in the House and the Senate. Those folks did not see eye to eye. As you mentioned, Jeff, Carter's trying to thread that needle in a way, and it makes his job difficult. Now, in terms of economic or energy-related matters, he is very much a centrist. He's not in favor of Ted Kennedy's National Health Plan. He's not in favor of the so-called Humphrey-Hawkins bill, which was going to commit the United States government to full employment. You know, he's a centrist. and he's got his eye on the budget. And that ticks off the left or the liberal wing of both the House and the Senate. The other thing that really ticks them off, Jeff, is he's in favor of energy deregulation. He wants to deregulate natural gas and deregulate the oil industry. That's a position that folks at the American Enterprise Institute
right.
and a lot of Republicans favored. He favored it. That was seen as something of a betrayal to these liberal Democrats of what they stood for. So that's a hopefully.
And particularly since he's coming in as an outsider to Washington, he probably doesn't have a lot of established relationships with members of Congress. How successful, how skillful was he in working with Congress when you're particularly talking about a powerful a speaker like Tip O'Neill?
Yeah, it depends on who you talk to, Jeff. If you talk to people who knew O'Neill and O'Neill himself in his memoir, Carter and particularly Carter's people around him were not adept at the legislative game. And O'Neill mentions a number of instances where he felt slighted. I mean, it got so bad that O'Neill refers to one of Carter's most prominent aides, Hamilton Jordan, as Hannibal Jerkin. He really had contempt for the Georgian or the Georgian mafia, as O'Neill would refer to them. If you read Carter and his folks, you know, they will talk about their attempts at outreach, etc. I do think there was some residual resentment amongst the Democratic congressional leadership. I mean, in a way, Carter ran against them in 76. And, you know, you sell yourself as an outsider and then you blow into town and all of a sudden you want to work with people that you had been fairly critical of throughout an entire year's worth of campaigning. So, you know, right from the start, there's this tension. There was also, I think, a tendency on the part of Jimmy Carter. He was such a smart man that he developed a mastery of almost any issue that he tackled. But the flip side of that, perhaps, was that he wasn't necessarily keen on taking advice from others, including members of Congress, some of whom also considered themselves masters of particular issues. So I do think there was a kind of brittleness to Jimmy Carter, even in dealing with his own party members in Congress, because he knew best. And somehow that came through, and it just didn't help things.
Before we continue with our conversation, I'd like to have one of our faculty members tell you about a special documents-based graduate program for teachers of American history, government, and civics.
Hi, this is John Moser, chair of the Master of Arts in American History and Government program at Ashland University. If you are an educator who teaches U.S. history, government, or politics, our program may be just what you've been looking for. Our approach is to emphasize primary sources, since we think the best way to study the past is to read the words of those who lived it. We have a distinguished faculty made up of professors from both Ashland University and from colleges and universities across the country. And they're not there to lecture to you. We think it's better to learn through conversation about the documents. Ours is a hybrid program with two different types of seminar. The first are our week-long intensive in-person courses during the summers on the beautiful campus of Ashland University. The second are our live synchronous online seminars offered throughout the year. So if you're a social studies teacher and you're looking to deepen your understanding of America's past and its politics, please check out the Master of Arts in American History and Government program. You can do that by visiting tah.org/programs.
What about on the foreign policy side? As you say, he seemed to inject a kind of moral principle into American foreign policy, which is a high priority on human rights, which had not been there before. Kind of trying to marry, as I understand what you're saying, pressure on the Soviet Union, moral pressure to comply with human rights, but also this kind of strategic detente and be concerned with nuclear arms and perhaps nuclear arms reduction. How does Carter try to navigate that tension, which is probably the Soviet Union is the biggest foreign policy issue America faces?
It is. It was. And it's again, another tough road. Carter's human rights initiatives appealed to a great extent to that liberal wing of the Democratic Party, but where it did not, where what the group within the Democratic Party that position alienated were folks like Scoop Jackson, Senator Henry Jackson from Washington State, who, again, another Washington insider, who had challenged Carter, by the way, in 1976 for the presidential nod. People forget about this. But Jackson was a hardliner on the Soviet Union. Jackson wanted to go even further than Carter did in terms of pressing the Soviets on human rights issues. So it's Senator Jackson who's really going to make the case for Andrei Sakharov, for Alexander Solzhenitsyn, for other prominent Soviet dissidents. I would think in the case of Jackson, that's more of a priority for him than detente. And you're going to see a circle form around Henry Jackson, many of whom are going to go on to work for Ronald Reagan, Elliot Abrams, other part of Jackson's team will end up in Reagan's White House. They are so hawkish on the Soviet Union. And again, Carter, again, is trying to thread a needle in a party that has such a broad expanse of ideological views. I mean, today that wouldn't be as much of a problem. Both parties are more ideologically coherent, but not so during the Carter years.
And what about the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan?
Yeah. So I should have mentioned Jeff Carter gives a speech 4 months or so into office at Notre Dame University in 1977, in which he urges the American people to move beyond, quote, our inordinate fear of communism, end quote. And very much extends the olive branch to the Soviet Union in terms of nuclear arms negotiations. That's another statement, by the way, that Henry Jackson was just appalled at. By the December of 1979, the Soviets on Christmas Eve invade Afghanistan. And Carter, to his credit, will later say, actually immediately says, I didn't see this coming. And it was something of a surprise. I underestimated the Soviet Union. And he begins to switch his position to taking a more hardline stance vis-a-vis the Soviets after Afghanistan. But that leads to the perception that this was a president who perhaps didn't have a firm compass, didn't have a firm set of principles when it came to the Soviet Union or foreign policy in general. You know, again, you can admire his candor. He flat out said, I didn't see it coming. I was wrong. But again, it played right into the hands of Scoop Jackson and Ronald Reagan and others who believe that Carter was too soft on the Soviets.
And then, of course, we come into 1980 after we've gone through this. Some progress has been made in deregulation, as I understand it, right? That yes. Sometimes people wrongly attribute that simply to Ronald Reagan. And as you suggest, it started under Jimmy Carter, airline deregulation, those sorts of things, right? Okay. So some success there, some success with stagflation, although not to the extent that Carter certainly wanted inflation to go down and economic activity to go up. And then we have the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan. It seems like Carter's in a difficult position come 1980. Yeah. And of course, a lot of listeners would remember 1980 and they think of the Olympics and Carter's decision on U.S. involvement in the Olympics.
Yeah. Carter. So the Moscow Olympics were scheduled for the summer of 1980 when the Soviets invade on Christmas Eve of 79. Carter begins to ponder banning American participation or putting pressure on the U.S. Olympic Committee to boycott the games, and he succeeds in that. By the way, we weren't alone. There were, I think, 30 to 40 nations that joined us in that boycott. There are some Olympic athletes to this day who have never forgiven President Carter for this decision. But I will say, after the Soviets invaded, I mean, there's the Olympic ban. He cuts off grain sales to the Soviet Union. Reagan, by the way, will restore those sales. And Carter proposes a massive defense buildup, a lot of which is given credit to President Reagan. rightly so, but it begins with Jimmy Carter. So as we enter 1980, there's now a more hawkish President Carter. I left out, Jeff, the seizure of the Iranian hostage to the U.S. Embassy in Iran. That's just barely a month before the Soviets invade Afghanistan. That's a double whammy right there. You have a group of revolutionaries in Tehran who seize the American embassy. They hold 52 hostages for 444 days. It was seen as a humiliation of the great Satan, as Khomeini liked to call us. The Carter attempts a military rescue mission in April of 1980 that fails and ends up killing some American soldiers. All of that is a heck of a lot of weight to try to overcome and win re-election for Carter in the fall of 80.
And in the meantime, as he's going to run again, you have this unusual situation where he has disappointed some liberals in the Democratic Party. He's disappointed the more conservative wing of the Democratic Party on different issues. And then you have an unusual situation, I think, in American political history, which is you have an incumbent president who looks like he's going to be challenged in the primary by a member of his own party.
Yeah, it was a remarkable situation, a unique, somewhat unique one, Jeff. To this day, it's not entirely clear why Ted Kennedy chose to run against Carter, and he himself even had difficulty explaining that decision. He gave a famous television interview with Roger Mudd, a CBS News correspondent, in which he was just flat out asked, why do you want to be president? And it was not a particularly coherent answer. But from Kennedy's perspective, there were liberal members of the House and Senate who were urging him to challenge their own president. And I should mention this as well, Carter was always reluctant to embrace Kennedy's national health plan. And that issue was percolating as well. So, and I do have to say, Jeff, having worked on the Edward M. Kennedy Oral History Project, we pressed Kennedy, this was in the early 2000s. It was still never entirely clear to me why he challenged a sitting president of his own party. Some of it was personal. And by that, I mean what I hinted at earlier. You asked me that question about Carter's relationships with members of Congress of his own party. Carter supposedly had sat on a medal that Congress had authorized to be given to Ethel Kennedy, the widow of Robert Kennedy, I think on the 10th anniversary of Robert Kennedy's murder, which would have been 1978. They didn't move on it. They didn't do anything about it. That's there as well, I think. I don't want to put it up there necessarily with healthcare, but it's there. And again, it was part of this broader perception that these rookie outsider Georgians were in over their head, did not know how to play the game, including with members of their own party. And there's definitely something to that. That's a factor for Kennedy jumping in. Carter, by the way, I think sort of aggravated the situation by fairly early on boasting that he would quote unquote whip Ted Kennedy's ass. Not the kind of healing rhetoric one might necessarily expect. And it became personal. Kennedy's going to take it all the way to the floor of the Democratic National Convention in New York City in June or July, I guess, of 1980. Very, very bitter fight. Kennedy didn't do particularly well, except towards the end, where he carried some of the major industrial states, California, Illinois, Pennsylvania, New York State, etc. So he went into that convention with a sizable block of delegates. And there's the famous scene where Carter's trying to lift Ted Kennedy's arm. They're going to be hand in hand to defeat Ronald Reagan. And he's basically chasing Kennedy across the stage to try to get him to lift his hand up with him. Doesn't succeed.
How badly did that hurt Carter in his run against Reagan?
Very badly, Jeff. No question it hurt him badly. And I know of a lot, I'm speaking to you today from Massachusetts. I know a lot of Kennedy Democrats who did not vote for Jimmy Carter. In fact, many voted for Ronald Reagan. And Ronald Reagan is going to carry, of all places, progressive Massachusetts in 1980 against Jimmy Carter.
That's hard to imagine.
It's just astounding. But there were so many Democrats of that Kennedy, more liberal wing that it had it with Jimmy Carter. And it's going to contribute to, I think, Ronald Reagan's 44th state victory against the sitting incumbent. This is one of the most ignominious defeats of any incumbent president. I think you have to go back to William Howard Taft to find someone who was defeated as badly as Carter. So Kennedy's challenge deeply wounded Carter's fall campaign. Kennedy did engage in a few fundraising events for Carter, but the strain, the division was clearly obvious, and it hurt Carter for sure.
The campaign against Reagan, what was the central issue that was really driving it?
Yeah, I think there was just a perception that Carter was in over his head and that the United States was slipping. You had still had runaway inflation. Reagan called it the misery index. High interest rates, high inflation, high unemployment. None of that was supposed to happen together. You know, it's usually high unemployment, low inflation, vice whatever. It was all coming together at once. The misery index, as Reagan called it, was brutal. I think the prime rate at one point was close to 20%. And gas lines, gas shortages. I remember sitting, I was a delivery guy in the summer of 79. And I remember you'd have to go odd or even to put half a tank of gas in. So if the last digit on your number plate was an odd number, you went on odd days and vice versa. Not a good situation.
Hard for us to imagine today, yeah.
Hard to imagine. And then on the foreign policy front, as I said, the double whammy, the hostage situation drags on right up to inauguration day in 1981. The Soviets are on the move, or at least seem to be, in Afghanistan, in Angola, in Africa, and in, according to Reagan and a lot of folks, in Nicaragua and El Salvador, in our own hemisphere. So, you know, there was no particular issue that I think was breaking Jimmy Carter's way come November of 1980.
What about Carter's character as president? What in facing these many difficulties, as you're making it clear, from all sides? Some of our listeners might remember him talking about malaise and the American spirit. Talk about his character and his sort of view of America in those times when he's president.
Yeah, terrific question. Carter delivers a speech in July 1979, known as the malaise speech. I'm sure many folks in your audience know he never actually uses that word. But the thrust of the speech, and he did use that word elsewhere, I should mention, just not in that speech. Thrust of the speech was that America was going through something of a psychic crisis, a crisis of confidence. And there's a hint that we're a little bit spoiled. We expect to have cheap energy. We expect to have unlimited frontiers, manifest destiny, whatever. No talk of limits. And Carter was trying to say, you know, we might have reached the point where we do need to talk about limits. And it was that speech was seen as a reprimand to the American public. You know, your folks, your audience can watch it on YouTube. I'll let them decide for themselves. But that's how it was seen at the time. A little too negative, a little too pessimistic. It's interesting to note, Rosalynn Carter, the First Lady, urged the president not to deliver that speech. And Vice President Walter Mondale also urged him not to deliver that speech.
And yet he thought he should.
He thought he should. And again, this, to your question, Jeff, this, I think, sheds light on an aspect of Carter's character. He was, to an extent, he's both an engineer of sorts, but he's a preacher. And, you know, deeply religious man, a man of incredible faith. And I think he felt duty bound to tell his parishioners that they were sinning. I hate that's a little too
Right.
Off the cuff.
That's not the normal thing that you often hear presidents say to the American people.
That is correct. And he had this capacity. And you know, again, he acknowledged himself being having the wrong take on the Soviet Union. There are other instances in his career where he would acknowledge mistakes he had made. And he wanted, I think, the American people to acknowledge some mistakes on their own part. But the American people were not inclined to listen.
After he's defeated, I mean, he just passed away recently, I think 100 years old. After he's defeated, he has one of the most significant, the longest post-presidential tenures in American history, if not the longest. And he seems to have rehabilitated himself to some degree in public life by being a kind of elder statesman, particularly in diplomatic areas for America, called on by presidents. Can you talk a little bit about the post-presidential career of Jimmy Carter?
Sure. Well, I think we all, most of us know about his work for Habitat for Humanity, building houses for folks who lacked affordable housing. And as you mentioned, Jeff, he raised money for the Carter Center, which is part of the Carter Library complex outside of Atlanta. And that Carter Center did some incredible work. I mean, Carter is, I'm told, primarily responsible for the elimination, or at least the containment, I guess, of something called the guinea worm in Africa, which is a real killer. And this is something he devoted years of his life working with doctors and aid providers and so forth to help eliminate this scourge. You know, that kind of thing is going to contribute to Carter winning the Nobel Peace Prize in 2002. He's in a select company there with Teddy Roosevelt and Woodrow Wilson, well, and Barack Obama now, too. But, you know, for the most part, a very positive humanitarian work both at home and abroad through the Carter Center. The one area, Jeff, where I, you know, I hate to speak ill of the recently deceased, but there were occasions, particularly during the two Bush presidencies, and believe it or not, Bill Clinton's presidency, where he really got under the skin of the sitting president. In the case of H.W. Bush, he actually publicly urged some of the Arab countries in 1990 to oppose Desert Storm, to oppose the American intervention, to compel Saddam Hussein to remove his forces from Kuwait. You know, that was a change.
Isn't that very unusual for an ex-president to speak publicly on an immediate issue?
Very, very. And needless to say, it irked President H.W. Bush and his foreign policy team. Carter was not successful, but he made the effort. Believe it or not, again, during the Clinton years, arguably an even worse relationship between Jimmy Carter and Bill Clinton. Two foreign policy crises or issues, North Korea and Haiti. In North Korea, Carter intervened with the communist dictatorship there and undermined, if you believe the Clinton folks, and I have to say I do, undermined the foreign policy of the Clinton administration, which was getting ready to take a fairly harsh stance towards North Korea and its nuclear weapons program. Carter flew there against the wishes of the Clinton administration. So he does that in North Korea, and he does it also in Haiti when there was an uprising there, the revolutionary discontent. He intervenes. The Clinton administration not only had to deal with folks in Haiti or North Korea, but they also, in a sense, had to negotiate with Jimmy Carter. That's not an ideal situation. One final example, Jeff. Under George W. Bush, Jimmy Carter was one of the harshest critics, you know, perhaps accurately so, rightly so, of American intervention in Iraq. But what I found troublesome, and I think some folks, certainly in the Bush administration, found troublesome, was Carter would criticize George W. Bush abroad. And I remember one time he was in London at some event, and he publicly criticized the sitting American president. Again, unprecedented, from my perspective, not particularly healthy.
Because there is this long tradition of American ex-presidents, certainly American ex-presidents, if they're critical of an administration, they can be critical when they're in the United States and often privately, but never publicly and not abroad.
That's absolutely correct, Jeff. I mean, believe it or not, Bill Clinton had a better relationship with Richard Nixon than he had with Jimmy Carter. And
wow.
It was because Nixon would speak with him on the phone or on a couple of occasions, meet with him privately in the White House and offer his advice. But for Carter, it at least had the appearance of, this is going to sound particularly harsh, of publicity seeking. I don't necessarily think that was his motive. I do think Jimmy Carter was a man of principle, but sometime those principles perhaps blinded him to some of the prudential necessities that come with being either a president or an ex-president.
You're a scholar. You've written extensively, as we said before, on American presidency, the history of the American presidency. What is the verdict now of scholars of the presidency on Jimmy Carter?
Yeah, I would say with the assessment of any president, Jeff, these things are somewhat fluid. Carter has been rising a bit in terms of those sort of C-SPAN type polls of presidential greatness. I'd say he's still sort of stuck somewhere in the middle, but he used to be hovering closer to the bottom. He's climbed up somewhat. This is going to sound like a cop-out, but we'll see. I do think, and you saw this in the outpouring, in the obituaries and in the tributes to him last month when he passed, his integrity, his incorruptibility does put him in good stead, or puts him in a, I think, glaring contrast with some more recent presidents, and that's only going to help him in terms of his assessment. I will say this, Jeff, I'm not one of those who says or thinks, and I may be in the minority on this, that his 43 years of post-presidential work should be factored in. I can't bring myself to do that. I remain somewhat committed to the idea that you judge a president what they do in their 4 or 8 or however many years they have in the Oval Office. So another part of your question, you know, to the extent that folks want to measure his post-presidency, that's only going to help. But for me, that's not a factor.
Mm. Well, it's a fascinating and important time in American history. And man, he is, as you portray him, a complex person. A person of principle, a person of integrity and corruptibility, but also a person who on occasion seemed to lack a certain prudence, as you put it, that seems to be requisite for the job. That's a complex, nuanced assessment, but man, deeply worthy of our own consideration. Steve, thanks for taking the time to shed some light on the life and presidency of Jimmy Carter.
Thank you, Jeff. It's always a pleasure to speak with you.
Thank you for listening to this episode of The American Idea. If you enjoyed this episode, remember to subscribe at Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts, and leave a 5-star review. If you want to learn more or get involved in Ashbrook's vital work, visit our website, ashbrook.org.